Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, hosting the Asian Festival, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. February 1st. It's a day of hands-on activities for kids and families with music, dance, martial arts demonstrations, food vendors preparing authentic Asian dishes, a gallery of bonsai trees, and other attractions. Details and ticket info at asianfestivalsa.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Bulimia, anorexia, other eating disorders, they're often perceived to be a white cultural experience affecting mostly cisgender women, but eating disorders don't discriminate. However, there is a lack of understanding about how cultural differences present themselves in the risk factors and treatment for eating disorders and body image pressure. It was one of the themes explored in the 2002 film Real Women Have Curves.
A grandmother is what I should be at this age.
You know, Anna, you're not bad looking. If you lost weight...
Just stop it.
You could be beautiful.
Stop it. You're overweight too. So why should I listen to you?
Anna, don't eat the flan.
America Ferrera, the actress in that scene, does eat the flan, but it was an act loaded with meaning and resentment. How can better understanding of the reality of eating disorders in our community help many of us find a healthy, symbiotic relationship with the food that we actually have in order to be healthy? Call in with your questions and comments, 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. Tweet at us at tprsource. We're joined this hour by May Lynn Reyes Rodriguez, Associate Professor in the Center of Excellence for Eating Disorders at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. May Lynn Reyes Rodriguez, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for the invitation.
Also with us, Claire Misko, CEO of the National Eating Disorders Association. Claire Misko, good to have you.
Good to be here.
And with us in the studio, Landry Yarborough, a clinical director for the Eating Recovery Center and Insight Behavioral Health Center in San Antonio. Landry Yarborough, good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
So let me go to May Lynn Reyes Rodriguez. And if you could tell me about the perception that we need to really highlight, really cast a spotlight on about how eating disorders is something that affects every demographic, every type of individual, that there is no one type of person who is most likely to have an eating disorder, and particularly when we think about people of color.
Yes. Historically, we know that we have been associated eating disorder with Caucasian population, specifically female from high class. And we know that now that eating disorder happen in any person, could be Latina, could be African-American, Asian-American. And I think that recently we have been like working very hard trying to raise the awareness that eating disorders don't discriminate based on race, ethnicity, or age, or even gender. So I think that this is why it is important to continue educating the people in order to provide the awareness. Because sometimes when Latina, specifically in my case that I am working with Latinas, when they don't see that there is information available at the community for Latina, they think that they are like struggling with something that is not necessarily related with them. And then the stigma of having an eating disorder on them could raise.
So May Lynn Reyes Rodriguez, there are individuals, say Latinas or even African-Americans, male and female, people in the LGBTQ community, they may feel like, I don't have an eating disorder, even though I feel a lot of anxiety about what I eat, when I eat, how I eat. And so I'm less likely to ask for help. And then also, when I do ask for help, I'm less likely to find it. And when I do find it, it is less likely to actually be tailored to my particular cultural background.
That's correct. And also the misperception is not only in the population, also could be on clinicians. Sometimes we can see clinicians that they don't refer Latinas or African American to specialized treatment because they think that eating disorder is not related with those from minority population. So it's something that we need to continue educating, not only the general population, but also providers.
Claire Misko with the National Eating Disorders Association, if you could back up just a little bit and help me understand more about what is it that we call an eating disorder?
Sure. Well, when we talk about eating disorders, we're really talking about a broad range of illnesses. And you mentioned in your introduction bulimia and anorexia. We also hear from many people who struggle with binge eating disorder, which is actually more prevalent than anorexia and bulimia combined. And there are a number of other eating disorders in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. And I'll also note that there are many people who contact our helpline. The National Eating Disorders Association runs a helpline, and we hear from many people who are struggling themselves or seeking help for a loved one, and they don't see themselves reflected in the mainstream coverage of eating disorders. So I really want to echo what Malin said. The stereotypes about eating disorders are a major barrier for people reaching out for help, for thinking or even understanding that what they are struggling with might actually be disordered eating. And unfortunately, that often results in people struggling for many, many years. The illness becomes very entrenched. We know that early intervention makes a huge difference in treatment outcomes. But unfortunately, because of the misperceptions in the broader culture about who is, supposed to struggle or what that stereotypical picture is, we have many, many people who are going years and years with no intervention whatsoever.
Claire Misko, if you could tell me a little bit more, because it seems like in our society, we're all fixated on food in one way or another, and worrying about what are we going to eat and what we weigh and, how we're going to get into those genes. When does that become an eating disorder?
Yeah, and that's a really important point because it often makes it difficult for people to recognize that their behavior, their thoughts and attitudes towards food, weight, body image, exercise are actually a problem because that obsession is very much validated in the broader culture. We hear so much talk about weight, diet. Now there are even more confusing messages because this is all wrapped up in conversations about health and wellness and fitness. I would say a general litmus test is to ask yourself, are your thoughts and behaviors about food, eating, interrupting your day-to-day life? Are they impacting your ability to engage in relationships? We often hear from people who are removing themselves from social situations because of their fear of food. And it's also important to note that eating disorders are very complex illnesses. We talk about them as biopsychosocial in the eating disorders field. So there's a lot of compelling evidence to show that these are illnesses that do have genetic and biological connections. Some people may be predisposed to developing eating disorders. There's also a strong connection to other psychological issues and other mental health diagnoses.
So we're gonna take a break. We're gonna take a deep dive into some of those issues about this is a psychological issue. This can be treated, but is that treatment going to be informed into the nuances that many cultural differences have? We're gonna take a break, and our phone lines are open. We ask you to call in. Do you think you have an eating disorder? Did you have one? Are you wrestling with these issues? You can be anonymous. The number is 210-614-8980. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about eating disorders, and we invite you to call in. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. With me in the studio, Landry Yarborough, Clinical Director for the Eating Recovery Center and Insight Behavioral Health Center here in San Antonio. And Landry, here in San Antonio, who comes to you? Do you have a particular type of individual, or is it anybody, everybody?
Anybody, everybody. We really see every age range. We start treating at the age of 10 here locally in San Antonio. We do treat 10-year-olds, and we get sometimes inquiries about children even younger than that who are struggling with eating disorder behaviors. We are fully integrated in the sense that we treat all genders, all gender identifications, all sexual orientations. And we do see people from a variety of ethnic backgrounds and as well as socioeconomic statuses. So really, truly, eating disorders don't discriminate at all whatsoever. And I can only agree with what the other speakers mentioned, and is that that's a huge, huge barrier to people getting treatment.
So the treatment, does it have to be tweaked at all for an individual coming from, you know, their background? Do you inquire into, like, well, how did you grow up? What was your relationship with food, you know, mm-hmm. in your household? And then you can try to come at it from there.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a part of our standard admission procedure for new patients or prospective patients. We talk about what their cultural history was like, how that may have impacted their relationship with food. One of the things that we know about eating disorders in general, and particularly the research that's been done on Latinas and Latinos with eating disorders, is that family involvement is really, really critical in the recovery process. And so we make an effort to include family in, and that may be blood family and it may be family of choice, but in all of our patients' treatment processes.
So we mentioned earlier this biopsychosocial matrix that is sort of locked into our each individual's relationship with food. How do you look at that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's, one of the questions that patients, their families ask almost immediately when they seek treatment with us is that they want to know why. They want to know why they're struggling, why they're having these thoughts and feelings, why it's so hard for them to do the normal things in their life or go to school or eat with friends. And so the biopsychosocial model is how we start to answer that question. Really, it digs into the heart that eating disorders are not a choice, but they're a coping mechanism. They're a mental health diagnosis. And so biologically, as was mentioned, eating disorders have a pretty significant genetic component in their development for most people. Current estimates range about 60 to 80% genetically based, which can mean that there are other people who struggle with disordered eating in the family, or it might be other mental health issues like substance use or anxiety or depression that can raise the risk factor as well.
May Lynn Reyes Rodriguez from the Center for Excellence for Eating Disorders. If you can talk about how issues like trauma, extreme poverty, some of the issues that many may have gone through, particularly if with a Latina focus, how that may be lay the foundation for someone who's going to have a lifelong struggle with healthy eating habits.
Yes. My experience with the Latino population is that we can find trauma and also food insecurity. Remember that also we have Latinos crossing the border, some of them undocumented. And when they experience the time that they are crossing the border, could be like 1 month, 2 months, without having any food during that period, that also can trigger the binge eating behavior. So it is important, not necessarily only with Latino population. We know that eating disorder also could be comorbid with trauma. So we need to assess trauma as a standard protocol for eating disorder evaluation. And also in the Latino population, or also in the diverse population, food insecurity is another piece that we have to look at. Because it could be a trigger for binge eating disorder or any other kind of eating disorder.
Let's go to the phone lines. Number is 210-614-8980. We really do want to have a community conversation this afternoon about this topic, and you can be anonymous, but if you can talk about your struggles with food and eating disorders and whether or not you felt that there was an avenue for you to find help, call in. We really want to hear from you, and your stories can help others. Let's go to Liz on the phone, and Liz, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. As I was listening, I was thinking it was really interesting because I'm an adult, and a couple of years ago, I found myself, trying to lose weight, doing, the calorie counting and stuff. And even as I did that, I would catch myself throwing up if I overate or anything like that. And this was after a lifetime of watching my dad kind of yo-yo diet. And so I caught myself on the borders of really mild bulimia, but there wasn't an avenue to fix that. I couldn't go to my parents. They're older and don't think that that's a thing. And so I think that for all cultures right now, it's incredibly important that we're educating them and letting people know that like you guys are saying, a mental issue a lot too. And it affects everyone, and we need to be treating it across the border, because even the people you would expect to have support for this don't necessarily have it.
Liz, thank you for that. Claire Misko, CEO of the National Eating Disorders Association. You tell your family that you're dealing with an eating disorder, and they may not, they may not be helpful because they're the reason why you've got an eating disorder, maybe.
Yeah, well, first of all, I want to thank Liz for sharing her experience, and it really does make a difference when people talk about these issues. They're often really shrouded in a lot of shame and secrecy, so it's helpful to hear from people who can share. I will say, one of the things that we talk about a lot at the National Eating Disorders Association, because we do work with a lot of families, we want to make sure that we're not playing the blame game. Families can really be very strong allies in treatment, as your other guest noted, and are often involved in the treatment process. But I will also note that because there is such a strong emphasis on weight and physical appearance and quote-unquote perfection in our culture, that, we are all caught up in this diet culture, which can, make it really difficult to recognize when behavior is problematic. And we know that dieting and restriction of food is a major risk factor and predictor of disordered eating. So it can make it difficult to have those conversations, because it can be really tricky to recognize when there's a problem, because we're hearing all of these messages coming at us. We're bombarded daily with so many images and messages that reinforce that diet weight loss mindset. So we really have to talk about that in the conversation about eating disorders.
May Lynn Reyes-Rodriguez with the Center for Excellence in Eating Disorders. In some Latino families, they may, that's how you're evaluated. They may have a niece or even a tia whose their name is La Gorda. Or, it's not that unusual to have that type of, who you are is really closely related to your body.
Yeah, that is true. In the Latino culture, we know that we emphasize the food is part of our culture. So in every kind of activity, we have to have food to celebrate or to mourning someone. And also the comments about physical appearance is very, very, very common in the Latino culture. So what I do with the Latino family is educating. First, I agree that we can blame the family. I think that we can use the family to support the patient treatment. And sometimes they trying to do their best. If they don't have the information, the knowledge how to do it, it is hard for them to do it. So in that sense, when we work together with the family, they start changing. So in that sense, what I do a lot with the Latino family is educating.
Let's go to a caller, 210-614-8980, Jessica. Jessica, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just wondering if your guest could address the fact that a lot of people who try to support people with eating disorders often boil it down to a self-control issue when it's so much more than that. And I'll take the answer off the air.
Jessica, thank you for your call. Landry Yarbrough is with us with the Eating Recovery Center and Insight Behavioral Health Center in San Antonio.
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think that that's such a common misperception about eating disorders is that they're all about self-control or a lack of control or trying to exert control over something. I think it's so much more fair and effective to look at eating disorders as a coping skill for emotions that a person doesn't know how to manage otherwise. It's not about looking good in a swimsuit. It's not about being vain or self-centered or not having the willpower that they need. And so we do a lot of education with our families and support people about the fact that it's not just ever one thing. Every individual with an eating disorder is unique within that diagnosis. And so we have to work together as a team, a multidisciplinary team, to really understand and support that person in the ways that best fit them.
So people are telling, they look at someone who says, I have an eating disorder, and they're saying, well, just don't do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just eat.
Or whatever. And you're like, I don't have a problem. Mm-hmm. Why do you have a problem?
Exactly. It's a really difficult thing for people to understand when they haven't walked in those shoes. Or when they haven't had the education, like Maylin was saying, about what eating disorders are and how they function.
And so Claire Misko, what's your uptake on that?
Yeah, we hear this often because of the misunderstanding about eating disorders. Another thing that we hear a lot from people, and we've talked about really, you know, how eating disorders can affect anyone, and these are illnesses that do affect a range of people. They also affect a diversity of body sizes. So one of the things that we hear a lot from people who contact us is that they don't fit that stereotypical picture of a, you know, young, white, underweight woman. And so they don't feel that their eating disorder is valid, or they might not occur to them that, or previously occurred to them that they had an eating disorder. And also there's a lot of shame around the fact that they're presenting in, you know, a body that isn't that stereotypical picture. And they have often even heard from other people that, oh, you can't have an eating disorder because you don't look like that. So we really, again, I think, have to talk about the size diversity of eating disorders as well. You cannot always tell and often can't tell by looking at someone that they're struggling with these issues.
And what about gender diversity in this as well? Are we seeing more men coming in saying, I have an eating disorder, Claire?
Yes, absolutely. And that's a really important, critical point. You know, when we look at the overall numbers of eating disorders, we talk about 30 million people will struggle with an eating disorder at some point in their lives. Right now, that breakdown is 20 million women and 10 million men. But we also know that number could be much higher because of these stereotypes and because of the fact that, you know, men are eating disorders are underdiagnosed generally. But for boys and men, that's especially true. So we know that there are many boys and men who are affected by eating disorders, and that barrier and that stereotype for them is even stronger.
It seems like they've come up with this whole different lexicon to talk about their relationship with food, and they have this fascination with intermittent fasting or other ways of trying to control their diet, and they put some pseudoscience behind it, but it's still, is it basically the same thing, Claire?
Yeah, and this gets back to, you know, what I was talking about around the messages about health and wellness. We are really facing so many conflicting and confusing messages about what it means to be healthy, what diet you need to follow, what is the latest fad or product to buy, you know, via social media. So that is a huge factor here.
Okay, so we'll talk more about that when we come back from the break. Our phone lines are open. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
LGBTQ Texans in the early 20th century were harassed and prosecuted.
Even as they were being discriminated against so heavily by society and by the state and by local law enforcement, they still persisted.
A young historian explores queer Texas history on the next Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about eating disorders, and they're all around us. Probably someone you know is dealing with the eating disorder. It might even be you. How are you coping with this, and have you reached out for help? What are you telling yourself about food? Call in. We want to hear your story. You don't have to give us your name. You can be anonymous. Make up another name. But we do want to hear your truth about food. Call in. The number is 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. Alandra Yarborough with the Eating Recovery Center and Insight Behavioral Health Center in San Antonio. What are the risk factors for someone who has an eating disorder?
Well, the risk factors are varied, and it's not ever just one thing that determines if a person develops an eating disorder or not. In addition to the genetic piece that predisposes a person, we also know that certain social experiences can trigger eating disorder behavior for the first time, or can trigger a relapse in someone who was maybe previously stable in their recovery.
Someone's gone through like food insecurity in their life. And we know there's a lot of people that applies
Absolutely.
To where at the end of the month, there's no food in the house. And maybe you know that it's going to be and you grow up always with that sort of panic going, I'm worried about food. And maybe your eating pattern is now, I just don't ever want to have to feel hunger again. So I'm always going to be eating.
Yeah. There's actually some really great research that shows that childhood food insecurity is a risk factor for the development of eating disorders in later life, particularly binge eating disorder, which is the most common eating disorder. So that trauma, that fearfulness that I'm going to be hungry, I don't want to feel hungry, can actually make a person at a higher risk to developing an eating disorder. And it's so understandable because that's a very scary and traumatizing experience to go through.
May Lynn Reyes Rodriguez at the Center of Excellence for Eating Disorders. How does it present itself? How does an eating disorder, whether it be anorexia or bulimia or even binge eating disorder, is it a person starts living with these conditions and they live in isolation and then they don't share it with anybody? I mean, how do they realize this is a problem?
We have a different kind of presentation in that sense. So, yes, we have patients who usually could wait until 7 years, for example, for bulimia to seek for professional help because they think that is normal. They don't think that could be something that they need professional help. For other patients, they can seek professional help early in the stage of the eating disorder. So we can see different kind of presentation in that sense. So I think that if we can identify the symptom as early as possible is the best, because then we can have the best outcome. So this is why I think that prevention, education is key. Primary care physicians should need to be educated about that because, for example, in the Latino population, they usually don't seek specialized treatment. The point of reference is primary care centers. So we need to provide that kind of information in the settings that they usually use for services.
Claire Misko, National Eating Disorders Association. I really want to get a better understanding of what binge eating is. I mean, we just went through Thanksgiving and the holidays. I ate a lot. I don't know if I was binge eating, but it seems like, you know, is binge eating something really particular about an eating behavior?
Well, I think the major differentiation when you're talking about eating a lot and feeling full, you know, most of us have had that experience. With binge eating disorder, it's really characterized by a sense of shame after a binge. A binge can be, you know, eating large quantities of food. Sometimes it's not, but that shame factor is really key. And I think that that's something that it's a very common eating disorder. It's the most common eating disorder, but it's a fairly new disorder in terms of having an official diagnosis. And we need a lot greater awareness in the broader culture because of its prevalence. So it is quite different than just overeating. And I would point to that intense feeling of shame. There's often secrecy involved too, and that's true of a lot of eating disorders. You know, the feeling of needing to hide the behavior. And so that can be a really key sign that there's a problem.
So binge eating, tell me more about how that is disruptive in someone's life and how it becomes fatal.
Well, all eating disorders, I mean, when we talk about eating disorders, we're talking about life-threatening illnesses. You know, so with all eating disorders, that in the importance of a diagnosis and treatment cannot be stressed enough. These are illnesses, you know, binge eating disorder included, that are highly disruptive in a person's life. You know, so again, there tends to be a lot of isolation, a lot of secrecy, you know, an inability to engage in relationships. You know, it takes over a person's life. It really dominates their thoughts. It interrupts all aspects of their life.
Landry Yarborough, can something like cognitive behavioral therapy on sort of an outpatient sort of method be a way to help someone deal with this type of behavior?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, is the gold standard for treatment for a lot of eating disorder presentations. One of the things that I think is really important is that if a person is able to find their way to an eating disorder specialist, a dietitian, a therapist, and they start to work on these issues, that's fantastic because so many people don't even get that far. So the use of evidence-based treatments by providers who are treating people who have eating disorders is so critical because we want to make sure as helpers that we're doing everything we can to give people their best shot at a full recovery from this illness.
Let's go back to the phone lines, 210-614-8980. If you want to call in and join the conversation, we welcome you. You don't have to give your actual name, but we do want to hear your story. Let's talk to Emily. And Emily, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much.
All right, go ahead.
So, my name is Emily, and I've had a best friend since we were 8 years old. We actually met at summer camp. And when she was 19, she told me that she was diagnosed with anorexia bulimia, which, I mean, as adolescents, you grow up with your best friend, you tell each other everything, and I had no idea that that was something that she was going through. You know, I felt almost guilty when I found out because how could I not know? And now I'm about to be 32 years old. We're still best friends. But I'm just wondering, you know, in this day and age, you're long-distance friends a lot of the time. So whether or not you're working next to somebody and you gain that trust or relationship, or you're, you know, across the country from them, how can you support, you know, your friend or your coworker if you know that this is something that they're going through and you care about them?
Emily, thank you for calling in. Claire Misko, National Eating Disorders Association. How can you answer Emily's question?
Well, the first thing that we always recommend to friends and loved ones is to educate yourself about eating disorders. And the experience of feeling that that guilt that Emily described for not knowing is very common. But it's also important to remember that people with eating disorders are very good at hiding their behavior. They spend a lot of time and energy on that. So it's not helpful to beat yourself up about that. The best thing to do is really to educate yourself. The National Eating Disorders Association has a toolkit for friends and families on our website at nationaleatingdisorders.org. We have a lot of information that's really designed and developed specifically for loved ones. The more you know about these eating disorders, the better prepared you can be to help someone you care about.
So, Claire, if someone comes up to me and says, you know, I'm pretty sure I have an eating disorder, I'm not sure, how should I react to that?
Well, the first thing to do is really to encourage that person, if they're not already getting professional help, to reach out for help. These are illnesses that are treatable, but they're not the kind of problem that you can fix on your own. As we've discussed, they're very, very complex illnesses that require comprehensive treatment. So, you know, as a friend or a family member, really supporting that person in finding help is number one. And to approach the conversation with openness, with love and kindness. You know, oftentimes people feel very judged. They feel ashamed. So really to reassure the person that you care about them and that you're committed to helping them get the support they need.
And should I react to that individual and comment on, well, you look great. I mean, I can't believe that you have an eating disorder. I mean, you could say something that will be triggery very easy.
Yeah. Commenting on a person's weight or physical appearance is a definite no. And that's something that often happens, and often with people, you know, who later find out that someone they care about has an eating disorder, and you think back about all the conversations you've had that are focused around weight and physical appearance, because again, it's all around us in our culture. You know, it's nearly impossible to go out to lunch and not have, you know, some comment made about, oh, I'm on a diet, or, you know, I'm ordering this, you know, dressing on the side, or how much weight did you, you know, isn't your goal for, you know, your New Year's resolution. I mean, this time of year in particular, diet and weight loss talk is all around us. So it is important to remember that, and that we don't always know. I mean, as you mentioned before, everyone knows someone who has an eating disorder, and we don't always know who those people are.
Okay, so I got to take another break. The phone line number is 210-614-8980. We want to hear your story about eating disorders. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Our call-in number is 210-614-8980. We're having a community conversation this afternoon about eating disorders. That they do not discriminate any type of individual, any sort of demographic, any sort of stereotype you can come up with. There is the vulnerability of eating disorder in that group, and they also have to have some awareness of the cultural context of that group or individual, and in order to come up with a very effective way to treat that. And there's a growing awareness of that in the community of people who research and treat eating disorders. If you got a question or comment about your relationship with food, and if you think it hasn't been the healthiest relationship with food, call in. The number is 210-614-8980. So Landry Yarborough, you're the clinical director for the Eating Recovery Center and Insight Behavioral Health Center here in San Antonio. What is RFID? I've been seeing about a little bit of RFID, but I've never heard about it.
You're not alone. Most people haven't heard of RFID. RFID is an acronym for Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder. It's one of the newer additions to the eating disorder spectrum. And what it looks like is essentially severe selective eating or picky eating. Some picky eating is normal in children as they grow, and most kids, you know, about 50% of kids will kind of go through that phase and grow out of it and move on, and it's not a problem for them. But there is a portion of individuals who continue to struggle with picky eating or selective eating into childhood, adolescence, even adulthood. And those are the people who fall into the category of ARFID. So it's similarly to the other eating disorders, it's a level of disruption to the person's life where maybe they're not able to go out to dinner with their coworkers because they're not sure that there's going to be any food on the menu that they can eat. Or they might not be able to, you know, have lunch in the school cafeteria.
Is it sort of a crossover of obsessive compulsive disorder and eating habits?
Not necessarily. There is a lot of research that shows that there's some degree of overlap or relationship between obsessive compulsive disorder and anorexia. Not to say that everybody who has one of those diagnoses automatically has the other one. But really, when we look at ARFID, it's much more about anxiety and depression. And so what you see a lot of the time is people who have a very small number of foods, maybe just 4 or 5 foods that they're willing to eat. And so they might be underweight, but they might be at an average weight range, depending on the foods that they're selecting. And it's not about the calories. It's not about wanting to limit the food intake. It's feeling that they can't eat enough. So these are people who don't have disrupted relationships with their bodies in the same way that we see in the other eating disorders.
Maylin Reyes-Rodriguez with the Center for Excellence in Eating Disorders. I hear about body dysmorphia. People have trying to change the way their body appears in multiple ways. And is this something that has impacted many of Latinas that have come to examine?
Mostly in the Latino population, they because we as a culture we have a different kind of body type. We are have a curvy type, and Latina feels that they don't fit into the American culture. So sometimes the changes that they wanted to do to their bodies is more an attempt to trying to fit into the American culture. Is the way in which if I am not Caucasian, this is not my culture, but then what can I do in order to fit in this culture? So sometimes the intent to change their body is another way to trying to fit into that culture.
All right, let's go to Jane on the phones. Jane, thanks for calling in. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, and thank you guys for doing this segment. I'm a provider, and I work with teens and adolescents with eating disorders, and I was hoping that you could comment on maybe some treatment approaches and how we address social media use in the context of treatment of eating disorders right now.
Jane, thank you for that call. Claire Misko, CEO of the National Eating Disorders Association. Is social media a factor in how people develop eating disorders?
Yeah, this question about social media is coming up more and more often. It's not a black and white issue. We certainly don't look to social media as a cause of eating disorders. But use of social media and engagement with social media can certainly amplify a lot of the thoughts and behaviors that are present with people who have eating disorders. There is a tendency to compare. Certainly for people with eating disorders, there's often perfectionism. So that gets played out in social media in a very literal way. I mean, you're engaging on platforms where you're collecting and looking at the number of likes you have on an image, and you're also exposed to, you know, a steady stream of images and messages that really reinforce very unrealistic and often downright unhealthy ideals. So it is something that we're very aware of in our work. On the flip side, we also see a lot of people in recovery and people who are striving toward more body acceptance using social media as a way of getting more diverse images. So there's a growing body positivity and body acceptance movement on social media. There are a lot of people who share and connect about their recovery experiences.
So do you tell people to shed the unrealistic, crazy gym rat type stuff and go towards a more healthy, realistic images in your Instagram feed?
Yeah, and that's one of the things about social media. Certainly, with the exception of advertising, we do have the ability to really curate the content that we're seeing. So if you're looking at your social media feed and, you're getting images from accounts that are, consistently making you feel bad about yourself or stoking that that drive for comparison, you can unfollow those accounts. You can actively seek out social media content that promotes more of a diverse representation of beauty and body acceptance. So that is something that we do encourage. And for some people, engagement with social media and participation on social media might just not be, a good or healthy thing for them. I mean, certainly we hear from people in treatment who have, completely disconnected from social media. That social media detox can sometimes be really healthy.
All right, let's go to Maria on the phones. Maria, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just wanted to kind of let you in on my story. I am Latina. My mother was morbidly obese, and she had really embedded into my head from a very young age to not be like her and to always stay as thin as I possibly can. And I've gone through very restrictive diets throughout the years. I'm in my 40s now, and I'm still struggling with it, but I struggle with dieting excessively. And then I have these really horrible episodes of binge eating till I get sick or till I throw up. And then I feel so guilty about it. Then I go back on my hardcore diet. And then I can't take the diet anymore. It's so restrictive. And then I binge eat again till I literally get ill. And looking at me, you would think that I would not. I look pretty fit. I do obsess about, about food. I'm also exercise obsessive as well. But if you look at me, you wouldn't think that that's my problem. But I have had, it still is an issue for me to diet and then to get so tired of it and then binge on junk food and get ill. So it is a real thing.
It is a real thing.
Which is normal. You don't have to be, overweight to
Maria,
have this disorder as well.
Thanks for calling in. I think your story was, a lot of people can relate exactly to what you just said. It means so much. And thank you for calling in. Landry Yarborough, what would you say to Maria?
Yeah, thank you, Maria, for sharing your story. It takes a lot of courage to speak out and say, this is what I've been through. And it helps other people. So thank you. It absolutely, that cyclical experience of the eating disorder behavior is something that is very common for people, regardless of what behaviors they're struggling with. So that feeling of dieting and deprivation then triggering extreme hunger, or, well, I've already messed up my diet for the day, so might as well eat whatever I want, and then kind of flipping to the other side and feeling really trapped in that cycle. Is a definite sign that, you are struggling and you need some support.
And you're human,
right? Because we are wired for black and white thinking. That's something that kind of our brains just do.
And we're really hard on ourselves. May Lynn Reyes Rodriguez, self-forgiveness, is that a part of this whole process?
Yes. It is true. And in her case, I think that I have the experience with others Latina having the same experience in order that having parents struggling also with any other kind of eating or disorder eating behavior. And then because of that, they are also struggling with an eating disorder. I think that what is important is to seek professional help. Dieting is one of the risk factors for eating disorders. So usually I
work more on a balance, trying to stay away from dieting behavior and trying to find a balance. Going to the extreme is what I call the unhealthy behavior. And so in that sense, if she can't seek professional help, she will eventually can feel better.
She can't do this by herself. May Lynn Reyes-Rodriguez, thank you for that. She's associate professor in the Center for Excellence in Eating Disorders at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Also with us this afternoon, Claire Misko, CEO of the National Eating Disorders Association. And with us in the studio, Landry Garborough, Clinical Director for the Eating Recovery Center and Insight Behavioral Health Center in San Antonio. I'm David Martin Davies. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.